going to discuss why we sometimes blame victims for the bad things that have happened to them and how and why we should change this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There is some victim blaming going on in the highest circles of politics these days, but we also see this happening when we maybe read about a crime in our community. Have you ever blamed a victim? Maybe you even have thought to yourself, your neighbor should have locked his garage if he didn't want someone stealing stuff from it. Or maybe you think when a sexual assault victim gets blamed for what happened to her, it's because of what she was wearing or because she was walking alone at night. So let's talk about the psychology of victim blaming and how we can avoid it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Have you, as a victim, ever been blamed? Have you ever participated in victim blaming? Our guest is Sherry Hamby, a clinical psychologist, a research professor of psychology, and director of the Life Pass Appalachian Research Center at the University of the South. She is also the founding editor of the American Psychological Association journal, Psychology of Violence, and she was recently quoted in a piece in The Atlantic, The Psychology of Victim Blaming. Good morning.
Good morning.
So define victim blaming. I was trying to give examples, but I was stumbling all over myself. What is victim blaming?
Those were terrific examples. Victim blaming is when we hear about a crime or a type of a violent incident of some sort, and instead of focusing on the perpetrator or perhaps even the environmental circumstances that allowed something to happen, we turn instead to the victim and put all of the responsibility and fault with that person.
So what causes that? Why in the world would we do that?
Well, right, that's a good question, because if you go up to somebody and say, hey, are you the kind of person that blames victims, you know, nobody's going to say yes to that question. But in fact, it's really common, and part of the reason why is because, and maybe even unbeknownst to ourselves, we often feel some sense of threat when we hear about other people's victimization, and that can help create a false sense of security if we turn and look at some sort of what seems like a mistake on the victim's part.
Yeah, so we think, well, I'm not going to walk home alone at night, and therefore I'm not going to, you know, be assaulted in some way by someone. If that person wasn't walking alone at night, that wouldn't have happened to them either.
Right, that's the kind of analysis. I mean, it's the basic sort of Monday morning quarterbacking. In hindsight, it's, you know, often quite easy to see, like, oh, well, that was the wrong person to talk to at a party or whatever the situation might be. But that doesn't mean that any reasonable person could have foreseen the way that events would turn out.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to say I was a victim, but I guess in a way I was. It wasn't anything as serious as sexual assault, but I had my wallet stolen from my purse, which was in my office more times than I can count, seriously. And I had not shut my door and locked it every time I left my office. And so there is a little bit of, well, you didn't lock it up in your office? Why didn't you lock it up in your office? And I have to admit, how many times do I have to have this happen to me to start locking it up in my office? But I still don't. But that's victim blaming too, isn't it? By saying, why didn't I lock my office if I didn't want my purse stolen?
Yes, that's absolutely victim blaming, and it's self-blame if you are doing it to yourself. And I think that's a perfect example of the psychological trap that a lot of victims get caught in, because, you know, there are costs to an intensely securitized environment. You know, do you really want to have to lock your office every single time that you step out for a moment? Mm-hmm. Would that be a reasonable response? Even if you decided that's what you wanted to do, you were all human, and that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be some time when you're in some kind of rush or you get some sort of urgent call or something like that, and you forget to do it because we can't all be, we're not robots. We're not 100% consistent in our behavior. And really, it should be safe to do that. It should be safe to leave your door open. It should be safe to forget to lock something up one time. And if somebody does come across that, the right thing to do would be to maybe close your door for you and go, oh, well, Joy, forgot to close your door. Or even just to kind of go like, well, it's nice that we have an environment like this where it's safe to leave our doors open. And it's really only a predator mentality that looks at that situation and sees that as an opportunity to commit a crime.
So how does victim blaming affect the victim?
Well, victim blaming is really a major source of trauma for victims. Sometimes the response of healthcare and criminal justice to crime victims is called terms like the second rape, for example, and sexual violence. It's that distressing and traumatizing. And I've known many, many victims who have said that in some ways it's even worse than the original assault.
Yeah. What about the people who are doing the blaming? Does it do anything to us if we are doing the blaming?
Well, I think that that's where the complexity lies. So there's this concept in psychology called the just world hypothesis, and people basically like to go around, especially it's a very American sensibility, to think that good things happen to good people and that, and they sort of pushes them to believe the opposite, even though it doesn't have to be this way, that if something bad happened, that you must somehow be a bad person. It's comforting to think that if you're a good person, that nothing bad is going to happen to you. And so I think that a lot of times what people who are blaming victims get that they don't even necessarily realize they're getting is that they get some sense of comfort and safety themselves out of it.
Yeah. And in that Atlantic article, you talked about that just world hypothesis, that we have the desire to see the world as just and fair and maybe even stronger among Americans. That desire might be even stronger among Americans. Why is that?
Well, it's part of the American dream. I mean, a lot of times, too, people, it just requires a lot of nuance to understand that it can be a legitimate need. Like, we all want to feel safe. So when we hear about a crime and then we want to be able to reassure ourselves that we're still safe, that's a perfectly legitimate need. And in the United States, it really ties into these broader central values of the American dream, that if you work hard and play by the rules, that good things will come your way and that you can offer a good life to your family and your children. And that is totally wonderful and legitimate, too. But a lot of times we don't realize that there can be sort of a dark side to even the most upstanding values, and that can mean that people find it hard to hear that bad things happen to good people, and that's how it can connect to victim blaming.
Yeah. Also in the article, you say that even the most well-intentioned people contribute to victim blaming. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of times that people, like the story that you told about your office, that if someone's like, well, you should keep your door shut, or, that might seem to them like they're making a constructive suggestion, but it is still putting the responsibility on you to somehow be able to eliminate all threat of crime against you, and that's just not possible for anybody to do. We can't control the behavior of all the bad guys that are out there.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it was a local police agency put out a crime prevention video not that long ago, actually, and it was telling University of Wisconsin students, women in particular, to always walk with somebody. Don't walk alone, and choose well-lit paths and this and that. And there was an outcry saying, hey, wait a minute, you're putting the onus on on the young woman, that if she walks alone and gets raped, that's, you know, that's her fault.
Right. I mean, part of the problem with messages like that is that they tend to be really one-sided, and that there's all these prevention messages that are aimed at women about what they can do to avoid becoming victims. Those aren't necessarily bad in and of themselves, but where are the messages to men to, you know, make sure that you understand consent and make sure that you are respecting other people's boundaries? And, you know, so that starts to bring gender roles, which is often a big part of victim blaming, especially the worst victim blaming, and the way that we can still make women responsible for controlling the sexuality of men, which is not women's job.
Do you think we victim blame differently based on different types of crimes?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that some crimes are rape, domestic violence. There's much worse victim blaming for that than there is, for example, like a stranger perpetrated mugging.
Yeah. Even blaming a victim of domestic abuse that she somehow asked for it.
Right. I mean, back in the 70s, when people first started paying attention to it, the psychologists are complicit in this sometimes, too. There were entire theories about how this was evidence of a masochistic personality disorder. Much in the dark days of psychology where, you know, people still treated homosexuality as a mental disorder and other, you know, seriously problematic things like that.
Yeah. I will say it, someone I know who is an older man was mugged while walking at night in a not a very populated area. And he too was warned. He was told by the police, don't walk at night, and then this isn't going to happen. I suppose, you know, you can be concerned about your safety and do things that are safe, but, I mean, blaming him, if you weren't walking at night, you wouldn't have been mugged.
Right, and I think that example also illustrates another problem that's missing from a lot of the prevention and crime reduction messages, is that there's no real acknowledgement that there needs to be some kind of balance. So the safest thing for all of us to do would probably become a hermit in the woods somewhere and never see anyone and give away all of our possessions so that we didn't have anything to steal. But we probably don't want to engage in those kinds of extreme behaviors. But when you really want to tell people, like, never go out after dark. I mean, you know, what, and really, if you were the theater or the movie industry, you probably would not be happy to hear that. But is that really a reasonable lifestyle expectation? The same thing happens to young women all the time, that they're told, warned off of drinking and going to parties, like it's a reasonable response to the threat of violence to not have any kind of social life at all.
We are talking about victim blaming and the psychology of victim blaming. Why do we do this? What does it do to the victim, to all of us, and what can we do to stop it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sherry Hamby, clinical psychologist, research professor of psychology, and director of the Life Pass Appalachian Research Center at the University of the South. She was recently quoted in a piece in The Atlantic, which we have posted on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, on the psychology of victim blaming. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about victim blaming this hour. And welcoming your examples and your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Have you, when you were in a situation, bad situation, ever been blamed for what happened? Have you ever participated in this? Maybe by saying things like, well, yeah, don't walk alone at night, or, hey, you should lock your doors if you don't want to be robbed. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sherry Hamby. She is a clinical psychologist. She was quoted in a piece in The Atlantic on the psychology of victim blaming. Let's before we start taking calls, talk about the gender factor. How does the gender factor play into victim blaming, Professor Hamby?
Well, gender definitely plays a big role in a lot of victim blaming. There are some gender roles, as I mentioned, where women still are perceived as having more responsibility for relationships and managing and navigating relationships, so that can contribute to victim blaming, and especially in domestic violence and sexual assault and those types of incidents. It also, you know, there's really, we have some pretty wishful ideas sometimes about what a pure, innocent victim really looks like, and gender can definitely play into that too. And I think both in the sense that, so any perceived flaw on a woman at all can really knock her off of that pedestal. So if she's been drinking, for example, even though if she's over 21, that's a perfectly legitimate choice that most American adults make, they can still lead to victim blaming. But I think that can also play a role in the way male victims are treated too, when they are either not believed or they experience gender-specific types of shame as well.
There is a very high profile, a lot of profile cases of victim blaming going on in politics these days, or in popular culture. Victim blaming, I guess, can be attributed to, in the case of Alicia Machado, the former Miss Universe, who Hillary Clinton brought it up in a debate that she had been treated poorly by Donald Trump. Donald Trump calling the former Miss Universe fat and some other things. And when this came out in that debate, Donald Trump turned around and started tweeting things along the lines of, you know, she wasn't a good Miss Universe. She had she was involved in a sex tape and all sorts of things along those lines. Talk a little bit about, is that victim blaming?
That is also victim blaming, and that example is a terrific example of how the perpetrator can also play a role in victim blaming and how much victims are mistreated after an incident. So in this case, it was really Donald Trump who was the one who was criticizing her and abusing her. And, you know, it's just remarkable that even someone who won the Miss Universe crown is deemed not holding up sufficiently to standards of beauty. I mean, what hope is there for the rest of us if Miss Universe is falling short, right? And so that's a classic maneuver of somebody who, especially somebody who engages in that kind of psychological criticism.
Yeah. What about blaming Hillary Clinton for the infidelity of her husband?
Yes, that's another, you know, really classic example. I mean, Bill Clinton obviously is the primary person responsible and the primary blameworthy person for being unfaithful to Hillary during their marriage. Perhaps in some of those cases, some of those other women might share some of the responsibility for having an affair with a married man. But a lot of the press, I mean, even kind of remarkably, a lot of the conservative press, which might normally encourage people to focus on the sanctity of marriage, are criticizing her for her choices that she's made when she was put in a really terrible situation that really nobody would ever want to be in. And yet there's been a remarkable lack of sympathy in some quarters for her plight.
So why don't we blame the perpetrator more than we do?
Well, you know, I think there's the need for control that goes back to that just world desire that if we put all of the responsibility on the perpetrator, then that means that we can't really take steps to protect our own safety. And so there's an urge to at least feel like we have something we can do about it. I think sometimes in some cases it's also a matter of privilege and whose stories that we are listening to. Men historically have always been successful at sort of telling a lot of stories from their point of view, and that way you understand some of the nuance and some of the complexities of their situation, whereas with the victim, it can sometimes get painted in more black and white terms.
Then there's the case of Brock Turner, that Stanford student who sexually assaulted a woman and I guess only got 6 months or some really light sentence. And we often heard him described as being promising, a successful athlete. How is his case an example of the way we treat perpetrators?
Right. Well, he's a perfect example of a privileged perpetrator and someone who, instead of using his, now fortunately most media outlets have switched after an outcry that was really wonderful to see, that it had some influence on the way the media were portraying him. But people were using his yearbook picture in news reports instead of his mugshot and talking about his swim records. And so there were all these positive pieces of information coming out about him and that were kind of filling in his story and making him seem really three-dimensional and making it seem like this couldn't possibly fit, these other character traits, even though he clearly did it and he was convicted, which is not that easy to have happen in American justice system. There were witnesses. But we weren't hearing anything comparable about the woman and what was her promise and what were her hopes and dreams. And so there's this, the more information we have about somebody, the more sympathetic we're going to feel about them. And, that is definitely contributes to victim blaming because it minimizes what it seems like he did. And it's sad to say that even that judge fell for that.
We are talking about victim blaming, why we sometimes blame the victims of crimes, or when something bad happens to someone, we somehow think the victim is partially responsible, if not totally responsible. We're talking about how victim blaming affects victims and how it affects us and what we can do to stop it. We'll talk some about ways we can prevent victim blaming. And we welcome your questions. We welcome your examples. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, we do have full lines, so let's start taking some calls. Sarah in Wabasha, or is it Wabasha, Minnesota?
It is Wabasha, Joy.
Yes. Hi.
Good morning. I am an advocate for victims of domestic violence, and victim blaming is kind of the story of my life. I see it daily. I have tried to turn things around by using the term target versus victim, because I feel like that gives them some power back. I feel like instead of taking all their hope away by them being the victim and making them feel hopeless, I try to make it positive and say, you were targeted by someone. This is not your fault.
Oh, well, interesting. What about using the word target instead of victim?
First, I would like to thank you for the work that you do on behalf of victims and our survivors. And I think language is hugely important, and that there's often real benefits to shifting to language like target or survivor. But there's, as long as you're not picking terms, I think target is a terrific one, but you have to be careful about picking terms that can also sound like euphemisms. So that's the only caution I would put out there. But I definitely think that language is a really powerful way to control and minimize victim blaming.
I thank you, ladies, for doing this show. It's such an important topic to be discussed, especially right now.
Yeah, well, and what do you mean by that, Sarah?
Well, I feel like there's so much of it going on with the election, and with Brock Turner and with other cases. Mm-hmm. You know, I hear in my daily life every day, well, why doesn't she just leave? Like it's some simple thing. What people don't understand is it's a great big gray area. There are finances. There are children. There are so many things that tie my clients to their abusers. It's just not as easy as dropping everything and leaving.
Yeah, that's a good example, Sarah. That's what we often hear. Why doesn't she just leave, Professor Hamby?
Yes, that is an absolute classic. That is really probably one of the most commonly uttered victim-blaming statements, and I completely agree with the caller that people don't realize how complicated it is just to, you know, come up with the cash to start over and put down a security deposit and rent a place. And if you have children together with the perpetrator, it's a little bit of a fantasy to think that you are really going to be able to get that perpetrator out of your life, because most courts are quite likely to give visitation rights of some kind to that person, and you might still have to be interacting even on a weekly or twice weekly basis with that person anyway. And so it also oversimplifies, as the caller said, the situation that so many victims find themselves in.
Yeah. You talk some about victim blaming and what we are seeing in the news even today. The comments that Donald Trump was caught making in 2005, and how that has played out, and now we are seeing women coming forward. New York Times are reporting that two or three women are saying, yeah, that happened to me.
Yeah, it's very brave of those women to come forward and really doing a service to make sure everybody has all of the information available, because they're no question that they're going to experience some criticism for their for coming forward and for their experiences. And you know, the only thing you can do is just be a voice to push back and to listen to survivors.
Let's go to Josh in Appleton. Hi, Josh.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me just fine?
We can hear you, Josh. Go ahead.
All right. I was just thinking about the relevance of the victim blaming with the Hillary Clinton situation, and was just curious of the thoughts of, you know, she was being the victim that was blamed for Bill Clinton's infidelity, but then at the same time blaming the victims of Bill Clinton for their actions, like a lot, like Paula Deen, for example, you know, Paula Jones, excuse me, drag a dollar bill through the trailer park and you never know what you'll get.
So did Hillary Clinton participate in victim blaming with the women who allege sexual misconduct on Bill Clinton's part?
Well, that is it's an important and it's a complicated question. I think that it probably depends a little bit on who you're talking about. If you're talking about people who had consensual affairs with Bill Clinton, then I think that they share in some of the blame for that. And if, you know, if I were the wife in that situation, I would be pretty upset with them. And I, you know, I don't think that would be blaming a victim. I think that would be blaming a co-conspirator of marital infidelity. Some of the other women who have come forward are alleging other types of incidents, and you know, I think then, it's probably more complicated. I don't know all that she's said about that, but some of them are more clearly participating in consensual affairs, and some of them have accused Bill Clinton of sexual harassment, and so it would depend a lot on who you were talking about.
Right. Let's go to Chance in Osseo. Hi, Chance.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I could not help but chime in this morning regarding what I see as essentially institutionalized victim blaming in the city of Eau Claire. And what I mean by that is that if you leave your keys in your car for any reason and your car is stolen, then you're issued a $200 fine. It's $213 or something. I myself received a stern warning from a police officer on a cold day while I left my truck idling outside a gas station. And I know someone that just had their vehicle stolen and received a $200 fine on top of that. And it seemed like, well, this is going to be our jumping off point. Well, why don't we fine people whose homes are robbed for having insufficient security systems and so forth?
That is, I had no idea that a city in Wisconsin was fining people for leaving their keys in their car if the car was stolen. What do you have any comment on that, Professor Hamby?
I would agree with the caller. I think that that is victim blaming, and that, you know, it should be, there's a lot of different situations, especially, and of climate like Wisconsin, where you might want to leave the car running for some reason, and it should be safe to do that. And again, if somebody sees a situation like that and it comes at it with a predator mentality, that is not really your fault, that we should not be getting fined for not being sufficiently securitized. And I just really think that's a classic example of this pendulum swinging way too far in the security direction.
Thank you very much, Chase, for the call. And producer Brianne Shasso did check into the authenticity of that claim. And apparently it is illegal to warm up your car with your doors unlocked in Eau Claire. So, yeah, you have to lock your keys in the car. Maybe you have to have a second set of keys. I don't know. We are talking about victim blaming. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Why do we victim blame, and how can we stop victim blaming? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the psychology of victim blaming with Sherry Hamby, who is a clinical psychologist, a research professor of psychology. And she was recently quoted in a piece in The Atlantic on the psychology of victim blaming, talking about how victim blaming comes in many forms, and sometimes even the most well-intentioned people can participate in it, talking about why we blame victims, its effects, and what we can do to stop it, and welcoming your examples or your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Rod in Madison is with us. Hi, Rod.
Hello.
Hi, Rod. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. You know, I think I'm struggling with the conversation in that I think it requires a balance. You know, I think that, you know, we teach new drivers to be defensive drivers because we cannot control everyone's actions on the road. If I was walking down State Street at 5 in the afternoon or in the evening and I was robbed, people I feel like would be sympathetic in the sense that I wasn't doing anything wrong and somebody just came out and robbed me. However, if I was walking down State Street at 3 in the morning by myself and then I was robbed, I think people would be less sympathetic because, you know, I feel like I would have put myself in a dangerous situation. You know, there are fewer people out as far as witnesses and other things of that nature. So there are situations where I think it's wrong to blame the victim. But then I think there are situations where common sense has to rule the day.
Yeah, hey, Rod, I walk near State Street, Park and University Street, at about 4 o'clock in the morning. What if I got mugged?
Well, I would say that, just like you guys had alluded to earlier, using extra precautions, allowing law enforcement to say, here's some avenues that you could use. But I think simply saying that if law enforcement tells you to carry mace and to carry an alarm or to be a concealed carry person, they're not saying that they're justifying somebody taking action against you. They're just saying, here's some ways that you can help protect yourself.
Yeah, so they're just helping me protect myself and others, Professor Hamby. And but back to Rod's original example, that is kind of how it works with us, isn't it? That we might not blame the victim at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, but we might wonder where was that person's common sense if it was 3 o'clock in the morning?
Well, I think that there's definitely needs to be a balance. In criminology, there's a phrase called hardening the target. And as we talked about a little bit before, we do some of the things that Rod, the caller, is talking about, that many of us will lock our doors, you know, at night, or we won't leave valuables sitting on the seat of our car. There are ways that we try to protect ourselves from identity theft online. There's lots of ways in which you try to protect yourself and your valuables and your family. The question is about balance, and I think your question back to him is a perfect example of that. So you have to be at work very early in the morning, and that puts you out into out into the streets quite early in the morning. And so, you know, does that mean that you should quit your job so that you're not on the streets at 4 o'clock in the morning? And often what's missing is that sense of balance. And often what's missing is that the first thing that people start asking or start thinking about is like, well, where was the mistake? What did they do that they shouldn't have done? But a lot of times the sad truth is that there wasn't a mistake, and that somebody making a perfectly reasonable choice where they really didn't have a better alternative, something bad still happened to them. And, you know, needing to be able to sit with that feeling that sometimes bad things happen to good people who haven't done anything wrong, that's what we really need to bring into the picture.
Here's another comment similar to Rod's, maybe a little more graphic. Michael on Facebook says, why do we call taking common sense precautions victim blaming? Yes, if a girl goes to a frat party, she is not at fault for getting raped. But telling her to avoid getting drunk at frat parties is not victim blaming. It's taking common sense precautions. What do you say to that?
I would disagree with that. I think that if somebody wants to go to a party and have a couple of alcoholic drinks, or even, you know, 3 or 4 alcoholic drinks, that's a completely normative behavior in the United States. Lots of people go to parties and drink. Why, you know, you could just as easily put it on the others. Like, you should tell those fraternity brothers, if they can't refrain from raping people when they're intoxicated, then this, a better solution would be, don't let the fraternity brothers get intoxicated. Why should the woman have to be the one that is responsible for controlling their sexuality?
Let's go to Jack and Viola next. Hi, Jack.
Good morning. I've been listening to this, and I'm a counselor. And the thing that bothers me a lot about this is, first of all, this whole thing about good things happen to bad good people and bad things happen to bad people is very a Puritan point of view. And that leads to a deeper issue, because what you're doing is talking about a reactionary type of thing. Well, what are we going to do when something bad happens to you? And blaming the victim is kind of a scapegoating thing that fits in with this narrative of good things happen to good people and bad things to bad people, because we deny the interpersonal interdependence between us and other people. You know, kind of like saying to the person who was caught as a thief and put into prison, it's like, well, okay, it's all your responsibility. No, well, gee, didn't we as a village raise that kid? Did we deal with that person's abuse? Did we not deal with that? So it's a larger, deeper issue rather than treating the symptom. We should be working at the cause, you know, like, and try to touch on it. Well, how do we raise men to deal with taking personal responsibility for our sex?
Professor Hamby?
Yeah, I would basically agree with that. I do want to make sure that I was clear that when I was talking about the just world hypothesis, that's a well-known psychological bias, that I'm not endorsing that people should think about the world in that way, that quite the opposite, that I, like I said, I think we need to be able to sit with the fact that sometimes bad things happen to good people. And I would also definitely agree with the point that there is a lot of times, you know, some real interconnections about vulnerabilities and lots of different situations, and that we also really need to think about how we can interrupt cycles of re-victimization or the intergenerational transmission of violence, where kids who have been victimized, as you suggest, can later on become perpetrators, and that there's a lot of other work to do as well.
Yeah, Marie from Appleton says victim blaming is an epidemic. It's at an epidemic level with schools, court systems, communities. Rather than looking at a broken system, they blame us parents and children. The court system has every incentive to financially reap the benefits of destroying families. Well, that's getting a little bit more specific, but I mean, what about her thought that the entire system, including schools and courts, and they blame the parents often for what's wrong with what's happening with children?
I definitely think that there are some big institutional and system level forces at play, and that we do really need to work on a much more contextualized and nuanced understanding of what's happening. I think some of what is coming out too, that, and I think the story you told earlier about how somebody stealing your wallet out of your office is a good example of this, is that some of these recent questions is that, we need to realize that it's a really common experience to get victimized, that by the time people reach adulthood, the vast majority of us will have experienced some kind of victimization, a property crime as has happened to you, or bullying, or some kind of peer victimization. And we do need to really step back and look at the big picture as that person suggests, and think about how we can solve the problem at the system level and better support parents and kids and everybody.
Robert in De Pere is with us. Hi, Robert. Robert, are you there? Oh, Robert thought that that women were blamed often in courts, I'm presuming in cases like domestic violence and sexual assault, in that the court system is mainly male. Do you think that gender has something to do with this, Professor Hamby?
Well, I think the funny thing about the court system and even our Bill of Rights is that we often don't realize how much it is really set up out of consideration for the rights of perpetrators. So a lot of the concerns of the founding fathers, who were all fathers, of course, it was to, against unwarranted search and seizure, the right to take the fifth, to not have to incriminate yourself. There are a lot of the rights that are built into our most fundamental founding documents are rights that protect the interests of perpetrators, and there aren't any rights that protect the interests of victims. And so I do think that the court system is set up as a, that there are wonderful things about it, and that certainly in many ways we have the best criminal justice system in the world, but there are a lot of incentives built into the system for lawyers to attack victims, and it's no surprise that that's what ends up happening a lot of the time.
Well, I'll spend a little bit of time talking about how we can prevent this. What can we do to be more supportive of victims and blame them less?
Right. Well, the first thing is just awareness. And it's great to see that many of your callers, this seems to be an issue that they've given a lot of consideration to. And just the more awareness there is, it's an essential part of training for most clinical psychologists and other healthcare practitioners and therapists, just to be aware that your sort of gut response might be to reassure yourself that you're safe in this situation when you hear something really bad, and to just you know, have the self-talk available, ready at hand to remind yourself that sometimes bad things happen to good people and that you need to be able to sit with what's happened to the person in front of you without blaming them. The other thing I think people can do is try to shift to a more positive lens. So instead of looking for that mistake, you know, what you could instead ask, like, well, what would have been safer, or how could I help this person, or how can we make this whole circumstance on states, maybe State Street needs more lights or needs more community police out walking the streets, or, you know, I mean, to try to be more solution focused instead of always analyzing for that key mistake that the victim made.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about resilience portfolios that you write about.
That's a new project of mine and my colleagues. And, you know, it's just the basic idea that nobody is good at everything. And as we've been saying, nobody's perfect all the time. And that what we're trying to do is shift the prevention and intervention towards this perspective of understanding that people just need a good portfolio the same way you might need an investment portfolio, like a reasonable number of different strengths of different types, and trying to make sure that everybody has like that minimum sufficient combination that they are ready to cope with adversity when it comes their way, which sooner or later it will come the way of almost all of us, and insulate us from as many adversities as possible, you know, recognizing that probably isn't going to be 100% possible.
Let's take one more call. Chris in Kenosha is with us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to just encourage the skill for all people to learn, which is to learn how to listen. As a social worker, we are taught that. There's a lot involved in it, but it goes a long way to being with somebody rather than just trying to give advice. I mean, I think giving advice comes from the need to control, like as was mentioned, and the need to fix, which is, you know, not a bad thing. You know, so I want to, I appreciate what the police do in terms of giving suggestions, and I feel like, you know, you're not going to get rid of that. I mean, that's part of fixing something. But
yeah, and because we're almost out of time, Chris, thank you. So how about learning to listen more to the victim, I don't know, console, but not necessarily give advice on how they could have fixed the situation?
Sure, and just asking open-ended questions, what can I do to help, offering support, I'm so sorry that happened to you, and just quickly, like, avoiding why questions, like, why did you go to that party, why were you walking so late at night, like, to staying away from those is like a quick way to be less victim blaming.
Yeah, so what would you like listeners to take away from our conversation on victim blaming?
Just mostly just to really try to put yourselves in the shoes of that other person. And if a victim discloses to you, to try to say the things to them that you hope somebody might say to you someday if you ever find yourself in a bad situation.
Thank you so much for being with us. Sherry Hamby, clinical psychologist, research professor of psychology, director of the LifePass Appalachian Research Center at the University of the South. Thanks to Brianne Chasso and to Nyasia Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come tomorrow at this time. It's the Week in Review. Two guests from different political perspectives talking about the top stories in politics this week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.